Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Livia Bitton Jackson, professor of history at City University of New York, and author of I've Lived a Thousand Years, Growing Up in the Holocaust, and Ellie, Coming of Age in the Holocaust. Dr. Bitton Jackson, born Ellie L. Friedman in Czechoslovakia, was 13 when she, her mother, and her brother were taken to Auschwitz. Her remarks were given as part of the celebration of National Holocaust Remembrance Day. The title of her talk will be, I've Lived a Thousand Years, A Holocaust Survivor's Story. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 21st, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our guest this evening, born Ellie L. Friedman in Czechoslovakia, was 13 when her mother and brother were taken to Auschwitz. They were liberated in 1945, and she came to the United States on a refugee boat in 1951. She received a Ph.D. in Hebrew culture and Jewish history from New York University. Dr. Bitton Jackson has been a professor of history at City University of New York for 37 years. She has written several books, including I've Lived a Thousand Years and Ellie, Coming of Age in the Holocaust, which has received numerous awards. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Livia Bitton Jackson.
I feel that this is too much honor that you're giving me. All I did was survive with God's help. And because I survived, I feel it's incumbent upon me to speak about those who did not. And in the memory of all those, I want to ask you, please don't consider me a VIP. I'm here only because by God's grace, I survived that hell. And I'm here to tell you about it so that by knowing, I hope it will be avoided, that the Holocaust to anybody, any other people, will never happen again. And the only way we can ensure that is if we learn about it, if we don't ignore it, if we know what brought it about. It's prejudice that brought it about. And unfortunately, there were enough people who have been inculcated with that prejudice long enough so that it culminated in this horrible tragedy of the human race. It wasn't only the tragedy of the Jewish people. It was also a tragedy of the human race that such a thing was possible in the 20th century. So my story is that I was born in Czechoslovakia, which was then a country, a republic. Since then, Czechoslovakia has been dismantled, and we have two states instead, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. I come from the area which is Slovakia, from a small town near the capital of Slovakia, which is called Bratislava, 18 kilometers from Bratislava. It was a small town, a Hungarian, ethnically, a Hungarian town, so that most people spoke Hungarian, but the schooling was Slovak. The official language was Slovak. My mother tongue is Hungarian. But I started the first grade in school, which was Slovak, when the Hungarian army marched into our town and into a narrow strip above the Danube, I come from a town right on the bank of the Danube. You see, the Danube divides Slovakia and Hungary. On the northern section of the Danube, in a shape like a long hot dog, is Slovakia. And the southern part of the Danube is Hungary. And in 1938, most of you probably know, the famous Munich Pact. When Hitler made a pact with a few leaders of Europe, among them Mussolini, and among them the regent of Hungary, and they all got a piece of the action for joining the axis of evil, as I would call it. And so Hungary got this strip of land from Slovakia, and in 1938, in the fall, the Hungarian army marched into our town. They crossed the Danube on boats, and they occupied the whole strip. Now, what difference did that make? On the one hand, the Hungarians were very much committed already to the Nazi program, so immediately my father's business was taken away from him. We had a general store. This was a farming community, and the town is like a long, narrow town with a main street in the middle. And the northern part of the main street was the Jewish community, the synagogue, the rabbi's home, the Jewish school, the Jewish slaughterhouse. It was like a little campus where the Jews lived. It so happens our family lived at the other end of the town, which was the farming community. So my father had a general store, and all the Hungarian farmers came. They were our customers. So we were very close with the Hungarian farming community, and we felt very comfortable among them. They were our friends and our customers. So much so that I was telling in the school earlier an episode where I had only Gentile friends. I didn't have Jewish friends as I grew up, because that was the neighborhood. And I had especially two very close friends. One was a Roman Catholic girl. Her name was Mady. And a Hungarian Lutheran girl whose name was Juliska, Julia. And the three of us were inseparable. We were always together. Now, speaking about stereotypes, I was very tall for my age, and I had very straight blonde hair, so that my mother was a little bit embarrassed that my hair is so straight, because the stereotype of the Jewish girl is curly hair, at least wavy hair. And blonde was out. You had to be brown or dark brown or even black hair, curly. That was the sign of beauty in a Jewish girl. So my mother was trying very hard. You know, in our area, they're growing a lot of walnuts. And I don't know if you have ever seen a walnut tree. The walnuts grow in a green kind of shell. And that green shell, if you open it and you cook it in boiling water, it produces a very, very dark liquid. And my mother was told that if she'll wash my hair in that, it will turn brown. I want you to know she washed my hair practically daily, and the hair remained blonde, and there was nothing she could do. Then she started to put curlers in my hair, and in the morning I would wake up and all the curlers were on the pillow and my hair was straight. So she became very, very desperate. Here she had a completely Gentile-looking girl, and she was very unhappy. So she decided to braid my hair. It was straight, so she made two braids, and that was really the end of the story. Nobody would believe that I am Jewish. And my two friends, Mady was much shorter, the Roman Catholic. She had dark hair, very curly. And my friend Yulishka was a little bit taller, but she had brown hair and wavy hair. And on one occasion, we went to the cemetery because Mady's parents sent her to water the flowers on her grandmother's grave in the Roman Catholic cemetery. And the three of us were nicely going. We are going to help Mady water the grave. But the attendant at the entrance of the cemetery looked at us and he says, "Where are you going? What are you doing here?" So Mady spoke up, said, "I came to water the flowers on my grandmother's grave." And he said, "Jews cannot come into this cemetery." And he grabbed the water can from Mady's hand, put it in my hand, and said, "You and you stay out of this Christian cemetery. You can go in." And I was the one who had to water Mady's. So it is amusing, but at the same time, it's also indicative of the prejudice that existed years before the rise of Hitler or the Nazi era. Because this kind of prejudice is mild and it's amusing. I'm the one who was sent in. Or another one, a very quick story. I was about five and we were sitting on the front steps of our house. We had an open front, the general store. And my mother heard, as my friend Yulishka was telling me, that, you know, the Jew was today in our house. And it so happens from the villages, there were some Jewish peddlers who would come in and buy feathers, the chicken feathers from the farmers. So the farmers, when they slaughter their chickens, they pluck the feathers, and these feathers were used in pillowcases and in coverings, blankets. So there were a number of Jews in the villages who this was their business. They would come and buy the feathers and then clean them and turn them into pillows. But why did Julia or Yulishka in Hungarian say that it was the Jew? Because this man had a beard. In our town, the Jews didn't wear any beards. Only the rabbi had a beard. But this Jew, this man had a beard, so he was called the Jew. And he was a Jew. But because of his beard, they called him the Jew. So she was telling me that the Jew was today in the house. And I said to her, "How? I have never seen a Jew. How does he look?" So she says, "Well, he's a man, and he has a beard, and he also has this sack that he picks up the feathers." So I said, "You know, I would like to see a Jew. Promise me the next time the Jew comes, you'll show him to me." So she promised, next time he comes, she'll run over and call me over so I can see a Jew. And after she went away, my mother calls me in. She heard this conversation. And she says to me, "You have never seen a Jew?" I said, "No, never. Yulishka gets the Jew, but he doesn't come to our house." So she says to me, "You don't know that you are a Jew?" So I said, "What? What do you mean?" And my mother then sat me down and explained to me that we are Jewish, that we are Jews, and Jew doesn't mean the man who is buying feathers and has a beard. It means it's a religion. Mady is Roman Catholic. You are Jewish. Yulishka is Lutheran. That's a religion, and you're Jewish. Now, that doesn't mean that we didn't keep our religion very strictly. It so happens my family was strictly Orthodox. Strictly Orthodox. We kept all the holidays strictly, and the Sabbath, and the kosher diet. But it never occurred to me that makes me different than my friend Julia or Mady. I grew up very innocently believed that we are all friends, and there is no difference between us. And then by the time I was in first grade, and that was 1938, when the Hungarians marched into our town, very soon I discovered what it meant to be a Jew. My father's business was taken away, and immediately a Gentile fellow was installed into our business, and it was called Aryanization. The Aryanization of the businesses meant that businesses were taken away from Jews and Gentiles were put in the place so that only Aryan people will have the mainstream of the marketplace. That was number one. So economically, it was a very big problem because no more business, no more livelihood. Then slowly, gradually, things started to change. The following year, an ordinance came out that Jews are not allowed to go into any public places. No parks, no libraries, no movie houses. Another ordinance came out after this. The Jews were not allowed to have Gentile maids who clean the houses or help out in any other way. Jews were, the midwife, the non-Jewish midwife, was not allowed to help a Jewish woman in her birth delivery. It so happens in our town there was only one midwife, and she was not Jewish. And from this point on, she was not allowed to help Jewish women in their delivery. So gradually, you see, the noose was tightening around us. And then the day came when we had to put on a yellow star. And I want to tell you, maybe you would be interested to know, how did we hear about these ordinances? There were no loudspeakers telling us. There was no radio. We lived in a town where telephones and radios were rare things. When you wanted to make a phone call, you went to the post office and you put in an order, and the post office wound up the telephone, and you gave them the number, and they called the other side, notified them that there is a phone call for them. That was the other town also had a post office with a central, and then the people were invited to come to the post office when we made the call. This was the telephone. So we didn't have cars. There was a truck in the village, but there were no radios. Only the very rich people had radios. To my knowledge, there were only two families who had radios, and believe me, they were not Jewish. Even though the stereotype is that the Jews are rich, it so happens the stereotypes are not quite correct. So how did we find out about these ordinances? We had somebody who was called the town crier. Have you ever heard that word? Town crier. He was a medium-height man, had a cap, flat, you know, like a very official military cap, had a military jacket, had a big drum with straps around his neck and two drumsticks, and he would start drumming, and then everybody would hear the drum, and they would run to the nearest corner. He stopped on all the corners. We had a corner house, so he came first to our corner house drumming, his legs akimbo, and he would shout, "Hear ye, hear ye." And the royal government of Hungary, even though they were a regency by now, but it was always called the royal government, decreed that, and this is going to be. So when he would take out the piece of paper and read it, and then he would make these announcements from tomorrow on, no Jews are allowed in the public places to go to the parks, to the libraries, etc. And I remember I was dying of embarrassment. I was so embarrassed in front of my Gentile friends that I am singled out. By now they knew that I was a Jew, and by now I knew that I was a Jew. And it was so embarrassing to me that I would be singled out and not allowed to go to the park, to the library, to the movie house. And so besides the fact that you were limited, you were not allowed, but for me the main point was of shame. I was very embarrassed for being, I felt that I'm being punished for something, some kind of a sin that I hadn't committed. And I did not quite understand why. And then the day came when the news was spread that all Jews have to wear a yellow star. And he specified it. It has to be made of canary yellow fabric. It has to be 10 centimeter in length, 10 centimeter in width, made in the form of a Jewish star. And it has to be stitched on every piece of garment, not only on the outer garment, but on every piece of garment. And without that, if a Jew leaves his or her house, will be severely punished, arrested and severely punished. And of course, my mother went immediately, bought the fabric. She made the stars for everybody, for all, and she sewed it on for me. And from that day on, I refused to leave the house. I refused to go out. I just would not be seen with the yellow star. But you see, let me tell you, I thought about it a lot. I wasn't ashamed to be a Jew. I was ashamed to be punished for being a Jew. That's what I was ashamed of. And I suffered very deeply already then, even though nobody hurt me physically. But this was already a gradual degeneration. Then I went to school. I really was sort of crawling alongside near the wall to the street when we went to school. And then after a while, that too ended. By this time, I was going to a non-Jewish school. You see, in Hungary, the first 4 years, it's called elementary. And then from the fifth grade, it is called intermediary school. I don't know how is it in the United States. So the fifth grade, we didn't have a Jewish school. So I went to a Christian school for fifth grade for the intermediate classes. And very soon, the teacher came in one morning and was very, very sorry to announce that all the Jewish girls, this was a girls' class, have to leave. They are no longer allowed in school. So we just simply walked out. There were five or six of us who were very embarrassed. We got up and we walked out of the class, and that was the end of the school. But for me especially, it was very painful because, as I said, I didn't look Jewish, and many of the school friends didn't know that I was Jewish. So when I stood up and went outside on the steps, there were some boys sitting, and one of them I had a crush on. I remember his name even today. And these boys were sitting, and we were walking down, the Jewish girls walking down the stairs, they started to sing. There was a Hungarian ditty, a very, very derogatory kind of song, that, hey, Jew girl, etc. And they started to sing this to us. And I was running down the stairs, and I was in tears. It was the beginning of a very, very deep humiliation from my own friends. So you see what happened. As soon as the persecution started, many of our friends, who were close friends, who never showed anti-Semitism, all of a sudden it became obvious. It became expressed openly. After we were ordered to wear the yellow star, we were also ordered to paint a yellow star on our house. It had to be 1 meter in length, 1 meter in width, and a deep canary yellow. And you know, after we had the yellow star on our house was no longer the Friedman Corner, as it was called by everybody, the Friedman Corner. No, it became a Jewish house. It lost its identity. And we had many people, youngsters, who would pass by the house and throw stones at our windows. Our windows were broken. One Friday night, I remember a bunch of young people were passing by and threw stones, and one stone flew through into the dining room where my father was just making what is called in Hebrew kiddush, the sanctification over the wine at the beginning of the dinner table. And the stone hit his hand, and the wine glass goblet broke and splattered, and we were shocked to the depths of our souls. It was very, very frightening, very, very hurtful. So these things people don't know about. When you speak about the 6 million who were murdered, it is a horrible thing. But when you talk about the individuals, as gradually you were being demeaned, you're being told how much you are hated because you are different. And then the day came when the town crier came with his drum. Hear ye, hear ye. Everybody gathered around, and it says, from tomorrow morning on, our government had ordered that the town of Shamoria, as it was called in Hungarian, Shamorin in Slovak, the town of Shamoria is going to be Judenrein. And he used the German term, which means free of Jews. Actually, the word Rhein, by the way, it's amazing how the connotation makes a difference. Rhein means clean, not free of Jews, but clean of Jews. And so we were given the order to hire a horse and buggy, and we were allowed to put whatever we wanted on that horse and buggy, and we had to leave the town for another town, which was designated as the ghetto, where several towns were gathered together, the Jews, in the synagogue yard. We had to go, and I remember that my father, my mother, I have an older brother, 4 years older, and myself. He was 17. I was 13 at the time. And my mother had a sister, Aunt Serena, whom I loved very much. She was a widow who had no children. So I was her pet, her favorite. And I must tell you, I'm so sorry, but I just suddenly thought of it. When I told my brother, he lives in Jerusalem now, when he found out that I'm going to Omaha, so he says, his wife became very angry. Why is she doing this? Omaha, where is she going? And what if something happens to her? Because I have been ill for a while now. I had a heart problem, etc. So why is she doing this? So my brother said, you know she has no brains. And you know why this saying, she has no brains? Because my Aunt Serena, I was very much attached to her. And I was very little. She was pushing me in a stroller. And my brother was walking next to the stroller. And I remember this clearly. She said to my brother, his nickname was Booby, and my name was Ellie. And she says, Booby, why don't you love me? Look at Ellie. She loves me so much. Why can't you love me like she does? And he said, because she has no brains. So since then, this saying, she has no brains, remained in the family. Every time I was doing a little bit wacky, and God knows my share of wackiness, but every time I was doing something, he was always explaining, what can we do? She has no brains. So my Aunt Serena came with us on the carriage, and we came to this ghetto. And please visualize this. I hope you have a good imagination. People from about 20 different villages were gathered, Jews, not people, Jews, into this area, in this town. It was a very small town. And in the campus of the synagogue yard, where the rabbi lived, the ritual slaughterer, where the Jewish school was, the synagogue, etc. And it had a yard. And we were put into the homes of those who lived in the synagogue yard. So, for instance, our family was put with an elderly couple who had one bedroom, one kitchen, and several other, they had a storehouse and so on. So we had to sleep wherever we could. I, for instance, was put in the bathtub. I was sleeping in the bathtub. They put a blanket under me and covered. So we were in this ghetto for about 4 weeks when the news came that all men between the ages of 18 and 45 have to line up at the gate of the ghetto the next morning at 5 o'clock in the morning so that they are going to be taken away to a Hungarian labor camp. Most of them ended up on the front lines. They were sent to the front lines to dig ditches, etc., for the army, for the Hungarian army in the war. So my father fell into this category. My brother didn't because he was not yet 18. He was just 17. And so my father was taken away very early in the morning. And unfortunately, I can't go into the detail of how painful it was for me because my mother promised that she'll wake me in the morning so I can say goodbye to him. And she didn't wake me. She was sorry for me, and I was sleeping, and I woke up when I heard the horse's hoofs, and I ran out to the beginning of the ghetto gate, across the yard to the gate, and I saw him only from his back, sitting on this carriage as he was taken away by the together with the other men. And it was an open wound in my heart ever since. I did not say goodbye to him, and I never saw him again. And then we were told we have to deliver all our paper goods, everything that's on paper. They put up a large table on the in the synagogue yard, and we had to deliver all the books, certificates, everything that you can imagine that's written on paper. And I was very heartbroken because I had written poems as my young life. And during this 4 weeks that we were there all together, I collected all my poems into a notebook. I had 105 poems in all. And here we had to deliver everything on paper. I took my father's Talmud. When we were brought into the ghetto, we took along all his Hebrew scholarly books and everything we had to deliver, and it was put on a large table, pictures, family marriage certificates, birth certificates, whatever. You can imagine everything that's written on paper. And there was this whole pile of disordered paper, and they told us, don't worry, you just deliver it, we take it from you now. When you come back from where you're being taken, you'll get it all back. But I looked at this terrific disorder, and I thought to myself, how will they ever give it back to us? I mean, how will they sort this out? So I took my notebook, hid it under my blouse, and I was running back to the apartment and hid my notebook under the pillow. And I was returning to come back. And just as I'm coming back to the yard, I see a flame, smoke. Everything was burning. They put all the paper to fire. On top of the whole pile were the Torah scrolls from the synagogue. The Torah scrolls the rabbi had to carry out, they were on top of the pile. And you know, Torah scrolls are not written on paper, they're written on parchment. So as they burned, the Torah scrolls were twisting and bits of the parchment were flying up in the air. And as I'm describing in the book, all of you who read it, it was one of the most horrible sights of my life. Even though later on, I survived many different things. But seeing the Torah scrolls burn and everything that we ever owned, our identity, was going up in flames after we were told that we're going to get it back. I remember there was a young woman who had a baby, and it was her baby's pictures in her hand. And she held one picture, and she asked the Hungarian officer, do I have to give you this one also? Can I keep just one tiny picture? And he says, no, drop it in the pile. And she says, will we get this back? He says, sure, you will get it all back. And then 15 minutes later, everything is going up in flames. You know, you can imagine a 13-year-old girl who had confidence in grown-ups. And here, look what they are doing to us. I felt that this is really the end. I didn't know what's going to happen to us. I only know that seeing that fire and seeing the Torah scrolls twist and dance in the fire, I knew that something terrible is going to happen to us. And the next morning, the cars were at the train station. We got the news that the cattle cars have arrived, so we were going to be taken to the trains. At this point, we were told that you are allowed to take anything that you can carry on your back. In a rucksack or any form of bag, you can put whatever you want, but that's all what you can carry away. Nothing else. All the other furniture pieces or whatever we schlepped to this ghetto have to be left behind. But you can carry whatever you wish. And when I speak to classes, to young people, I always ask them, so suppose, God forbid, and really pray to God it should never happen to anyone else, but if God forbid it happened to you today, that you are told that from all your possessions, everything that you like, everything that you own, that you are attached to, you are allowed to take a sackful. My mother made these sacks out of pillowcases. You can put in it whatever you want, and you can take it. Do you know what you would put in it? Think about it. What would you put into that video? I want to tell you the story that I promised Mr. Colony that I will tell you this story. In England, I had done a lot of lecturing, and my book is coming out also by an English publisher, and they organized for me a lecture tour. Different places. I was up north in Liverpool, in Oxford, and different places. But in London, they have a system that every library, every public library, has once a month an open house for students from the neighborhood. They can come and listen to an author. Authors are invited to speak. So one of the areas, and I spoke in many different libraries, but this one, Pimlico. Anybody knows London? This is a section called Pimlico and has a huge library. And on that day, when I came to speak and somebody from the publishers took me there, it turned out that that neighborhood is all Muslims live there, mostly Pakistanis, Muslims, Muslim students, a whole crowd of Muslim students, the women, the girls with their black veils, and the guys also had all kinds of headgear. And I was introduced that this author comes from Israel. She's an Israeli author, a survivor of the Holocaust, and she'll speak to you about her books. I had two books at that time for sale. The first one, I Have Lived a Thousand Years, and the sequel, My Bridges of Hope. And she's going to talk to you about her experiences during the Holocaust. And the young lady from the publishing house said, I was so sorry for poor Livia when she was introduced as coming from Israel and that she's going to talk about her survival of Holocaust. The hatred from the eyes of the students was so thick in the air that you could cut it with a knife. That's what Wendy described it later. And it's true. Immediately there was a very hostile atmosphere there. But I ignored it. And I was telling them the story exactly the way I am telling you. And I asked them also about the pillowcase. What would you put in that pillowcase if it was your turn? And they all told different things, different. Somebody said I would put in my telephone, my phone. I said we had no phones. But there were different things. Most of them said pictures, by the way. And then there was one girl who said, I would put in my Quran, take along my Quran. I said, wonderful, you are just like me. I also was a religious girl. I didn't take my Quran because I'm not a Muslim, I'm Jewish. And the Jews don't have a Quran, but they pray from prayer books. You know, the Muslims read the Quran for prayer. The Jews have prayer books. And I said, and I also put my prayer book into my sack. And you know how you say prayer book in Hebrew? Sidur. S-I-D-D-U-R. Sidur. I said, pronounce it. And she said, Sidur. And I made several students pronounce the word Sidur. I said, great. Now you know a Hebrew word. Congratulations. And I went on like this with them, and I stopped, and I, from time to time, I deliberately used Hebrew words, and I made them repeat it, and they repeated it, and I applauded them. I said, soon you will know Hebrew. And I taught them about 5 or 6, maybe even 10 Hebrew words during the lecture. And they were so excited about learning Hebrew words. By the end of the lecture, they were so moved. They were crying. They were very emotional about it. They came up at the end of the lecture, and they hugged me and kissed me and thanked me. And when they walked out and I had to sign the books, every single book was bought by them. It was so amazing. So that shows you how prejudice is taught. Prejudice is not in the human heart. That is only taught. They were taught to hate Israel. So when I was introduced that I'm from Israel, they expressed their hatred. But once they got to know me, I was the young woman, 13-year-old, that they were at the time. And they felt what I felt. And this is precisely what I believe, that every human being is the same. The soul is like every fellow human being. And all you have to do is to teach our human kindness, to unteach prejudice. Prejudice is the source of all evil. And this is why I'm talking to you, to tell you, because I want you, please, pick up the thread and continue. We were put into the trains. We were put on the trains carrying our precious belongings on our backs. By the way, the cars are not cattle cars that we were put in, because cattle cars have little window up there for the cattle to get some air. We had no window. There was no air in that car. It was just a train car for some other cargo, maybe wheat, maybe corn, not live cargo. That's where we were put in, 130 each. We were crowded without a small amount of space, so everybody had to pull their legs up. And this is how we crowded. Now, we were not all 13-year-old children or 17-year-old boys. There were old people there, very old. Some handicapped people with their canes, little children, mothers with their babies. We were squeezed into this car, and when the doors closed, it was pitch black. And the little children started to cry and scream from fear. But I didn't, because I was already 13, and I was big, and I was not allowed to show that I'm also afraid, but I was petrified with fear. And then after the doors closed, we started for more than 3 days. It was Thursday morning. The train was going and going and going. All day Thursday, all day Friday, all day Saturday. Early Sunday morning, very early, must have been between 4 or 5 in the morning, that the train came to a stop and the doors were flung open, and some men in striped uniform, we found out they were prisoners in Auschwitz, jumped into the train and shouted at us, "Raus! Alles heraus!" And which means out, everybody out. And we didn't have a chance to put on a sweater. It was terribly cold in the morning, but we took off everything because we were very hot in the closed wagon. So people wanted to grab their sweaters, their jackets, and they didn't let you. Leave it there. Leave everything there. Out. So even those carefully selected treasures that we took along on our backs, we had to leave in the train. And out, and you lined up, and we were driven. March ahead. Men on the other side, so my brother had to jump across. There was a wire between the train tracks, and men had to line up on the other side, and we women were marching. What women? Men, the mothers with their children, both boys and girls, and men like my brother or maybe 15, 16-year-olds had to go to the other side. And here we are marching. Dogs were barking. It was very, very cold and very dark. There was a slight light on the sky. And we were marching, frightened, little children crying and screaming. I remember one of my neighbors turned around and said to the guy in the striped uniform, "Oh, I forgot the diapers in the train. May I go back for the diapers? I have two very small babies. I need the diapers." And the man said to her, "Lady, where you are going, you will not need any diapers." And her eyes opened in fear, and she didn't ask any questions. She just marched on. So this is how we were marching, mothers holding on to their children, carrying their children, old people with their sticks, handicapped, all marching and marching, until we came to a point where there was an SS officer in a gray uniform standing with legs akimbo with a stick in hand. There were two other SS men on each side. And he was making a selection. And he was sending all the mothers with the children and the old people. And old men above 45. The young children up to, later we found out exactly the age 16. Up to age 16, you went with your mother to the left. And the young people above 16 up to the age of 45 to the right. And we understood this to be that the old people and the mothers with their children are being sent to a camp where they will not work. And the able-bodied young people are sent to the right to the workforce labor. So we were selected. My mother and my aunt and myself, we were locked arm in arm. And being that all my friends and their mothers ahead of me were all already being sent to the left, so we didn't wait. We were also already quickly marching. You know how frightened you are when dogs are barking. And they had those whips that the handle, a wood handle, and very long leather whip at the end, so they would beat you as you were marching, that faster, faster. So you were so frightened, we didn't wait to be selected. We started marching straight to the left. And Mengele, the one who did the selection, was the famous Dr. Joseph Mengele. Now we know he was called the angel of death. At that time, we didn't know who it is or what is happening to us. I only know that he struck me with his stick. He reached out, struck me over the head because I was tall for my age and had these blonde, long braids. By then, I had very, very long braids, very thick hair. So he noticed me, tapped me on the head and called me back. He says, "Du, komm zurück," in German. "You, come back." And I speak German. I understood him. I came back. And he says, "Bist du Jüdin? You are Jewish? You are a Jewish girl?" I said, "Ja, ich bin Jüdin." I figured, what would I be doing here if I wouldn't be a Jew? And he took one of my braids in his hand and he said, "Was für eine schöne goldene Haare hast du? What beautiful golden hair you have." And I was shivering from fright. I didn't know what he wants with me. And then he says, "Wie alt bist du? How old are you?" And I said, "Ich bin 13 Jahre alt. I'm 13 years old." And he said, looks at me. He says, "Okay, you go this way. And from now on, remember, you are 16 years old." Can you imagine this? Just because I looked like an Aryan, because that was the ideal Aryan look, tall and blonde and blue-eyed. He He couldn't believe that I was Jewish. And my mother was very frightened. She looked very frightened to see what's happening to me. They took her little girl from her. The open eyes, she had very large blue eyes, my mother. And he said to me, "Is this your mother, deine Mutter?" I said, "Yes, this is my mother." So he says, "Mother, come, you go with your daughter." And my aunt, who looked Jewish, she was shorter, she had big brown eyes, she had also her hair covered. You couldn't tell that she had brown hair, but she was shorter, she had darker complexion. She wanted to come with us. She started to scream, "Laura, Laura, please don't leave me." My mother's name was Laura. And my mother became very confused and said, "Herr Offizier, can I go with my sister? She needs me." He says, "No, you go with your daughter." And he gave a push to my aunt, and my aunt fell down, and there was a puddle. It had rained during the night, and she fell into the puddle, and she got up, and again she wanted to run after us, and another assessment gave her a terrific strike, and again she fell down. And when she fell down the second time, I screamed, "Aunt Serena, I'll never see you again." And I don't know why I said that, because I didn't know what is happening to us. I didn't know that those people who are marching to the left, the mothers, the little children, and the elderly, within the hour, they were suffocating in the gas chambers. We didn't know that. Why I said that, I don't know. I only know that I was a scared kid, a 13-year-old. And when I saw this horror happening, I said that to her, and that made her even more frightened, and she jumped up, and again she wanted to run after us. And again they gave her a hit with the strap, and she walked away to the left, and of course I never saw her again. I think I have to stop here, because now it's 5 to 8. I'm very sorry, I cannot keep you longer. If you want to know the rest of the story, please read my book. This was a commercial.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Olivia Baton Jackson, professor of history at City University of New York, and author of I've Lived 1,000 Years, Growing Up in the Holocaust, and Ellie, Coming of Age in the Holocaust. The title of her talk was I've Lived 1,000 Years, A Holocaust Survivor's Story. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 21st, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.